just inside the library at UMKC, there's a computer lab. It's kind of small. Maybe 15 computers line the room. This isn't the computer lab you might imagine from your childhood, but it's the same basic idea, and midday on a Tuesday, almost all of the computers are occupied. Fortunately, there's another computer lab just upstairs. This one's about 3 times the size of the other, and it's basically full, too.
It depends on the time of the semester, during, like, midterms and finals and stuff.
But wait, don't they all own laptops?
I'm usually more productive when I'm using one of the computers in the computer lab than when I'm using my laptop. I don't know why. Probably I just feel more studious. I don't know.
The rows of monitors and keyboards, the wires. It's easy to imagine those will be a thing of the past in another 30 or 40 years. Maybe. But what would they be replaced with? And when you're building a college or university to last, how do you do it when you don't know what the future holds? I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're finding out at least one vision for what that college campus of the future could look like. Besides the computer lab, what's on its way out? What's on its way in? Jeff Funovitz, you're joining us by Skype from your office in Pittsburgh. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us. If I walk off a college campus today and don't go back until 30 years from now, what's the biggest change I'm going to see when I return?
Well, we've done some research into what we think the college of campus of 2050 is going to look like, and we started to frame our thinking around 3 various themes: convergence, resilience, and lifestyle. So when you return to campus, hopefully you'll start to see some of these things popping up. Speaking about convergence, we see a trend of things coming together more than they had typically been in the past. Campuses are traditionally built with purpose-built environments, so classroom buildings, dining halls, libraries, each one had a very specific purpose.
And those were all separate
as
buildings.
As we move into the future, we see
And those are all separate buildings in different parts of campus.
Correct. All separate buildings. So as we look at convergence, we're already starting to see things like corporate partnerships forming on campuses, interdisciplinary research starting to pop up. But we see that really trending even further to perhaps environments where students and faculty converge on a more regular basis, perhaps even the elimination of faculty offices and really creating an integrated learning environment that becomes part of their lifestyle.
Well, now you're making trouble talking about eliminating faculty offices.
Oh, yeah. We like that one.
Well, we should say that Jeff Funovitz is a principal with Populous, which I suppose is surprising. We think of that as a Kansas City architecture firm, not a Pittsburgh one where you are. And mainly it's a company that designs stadiums. So you work on college campuses. How did you get into this?
I've been practicing for almost 30 years now. I spent about the first 10 years of my career working in private development, so doing a lot of mixed-use urban planning. And then the last 10 to 15 years really concentrating on just college campuses. Populous is a firm that is known for stadium design and arena design. And about 2 years ago, they brought me aboard to expand that practice and to start to look at college campuses. Our firm is really built around the practice of designing places that draw people together. So college campuses was sort of a natural outgrowth through a lot of the collegiate sports work that we do.
And so walk us through this. I mean, you've been working on campuses now for a long time. When you walk around a typical campus today, you look up and what do you see and think to yourself, wow, now that's got to change?
Well, I always take it back to when I went to college, which was 30 years ago, and it's always very fascinating to me that really not much has changed. I've had personal experiences recently with taking my own daughter to college campuses, and as you do the tours, you realize that really not a lot has changed. As much as people are talking about higher education in dire need of disruptive change, it really hasn't happened yet. We're seeing some movement towards things like flipped classrooms, where it's no longer a sort of preacher at the pulpit model where you have an instructor standing in front of the classroom. They're becoming more of a facilitator in the discussions. But for the most part, campus facilities really haven't changed.
And so what? I mean, what if it isn't broke, why fix it?
Well, I think it is broken. If you look at what's happening and what's trending across the nation right now, most of the headlines that you'll read talk about college institutions being in financial difficulties, whether it's through state funding, whether it's through dropping enrollments. But there really are impacts happening financially. There's a lot of questions coming out of the students' minds. Is the inflated cost of tuition worth the investment? So clearly there is something broken, and there are discussions on how to fix it, but again, really not a lot of action to date.
So I'm hearing a couple of things from you. I'm hearing that there's a financial incentive, given the declining enrollments and perhaps less state funding in many cases for higher ed. So it makes sense for spaces to be more flexible and more, as you said, resilient. But I'm also hearing concern for how people learn most effectively and how models of learning are changing. So to go back to our example, when you think about something like a computer lab in a library, I mean, what's your process for planning and design around something like that?
Well, I think maybe we can talk about it a little more broadly. Society is changing in the way we learn, the way we interact with people. Everything is really changing. And again, to us, that model in higher education has not. Today, things are on demand. Everybody wants everything when they want it, where they want it. So there are a lot of opportunities to start to change the way people interact and the way people come together on college campuses. So perhaps instead of distance learning being something that happens by an individual in their dorm room or an individual in a computer lab, distance learning becomes a group activity. So designing spaces that bring people together in groups for distance learning with other like-minded students, perhaps across the country, perhaps overseas.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, is part of this that major philanthropists or donors, people want to support a gym or a student center and or a library and not a multi-use building, not something that doesn't have that kind of, I don't know, character and identity.
Well, we do see some of that changing already with some of the corporate partnerships that are starting to pop up. Corporations are looking for individuals who are certainly trained, but who are also collaborative, innovative thinkers, and they're sponsoring spaces that that allow students to be just that while they're still on campus. I would certainly love to see a big donor come to the table and sponsor a learning environment and not just a specific single-use building.
Yeah, you're talking a lot about sort of the functionality and maybe the finances too. I wonder about sort of just the atmosphere. You know, you walk onto a campus, and maybe especially a campus that you associate with excellence or tradition, and it looks a certain way, stately old buildings around a quad. You know what I mean?
Sure.
How does that affect this? Are you able to really mess with that model, or can you make the kinds of changes you're talking about without changing that vibe?
What we're trying to change is what happens for the most part inside the building. So there's certainly opportunities to go in and do surgical renovations to all of the historic buildings on campus. We're not necessarily proposing that we take down every historic building and every building on a campus and rebuild it with just this big multi-use behemoth. And again, we're starting to see some of these things happening and happening in old buildings with the introduction of informal learning spaces into older classroom buildings. So these are spaces where before class or after class, students are able to get together to work on group projects, to just connect, to meet with their instructors. But it's a lot of learning that is happening outside the classroom and providing those kind of environments that can be flexible for different kinds of activities.
It sounds like you're proposing departures from traditional design that have particular social outcomes in mind, as well as architectural ones.
Yeah, there was a really great study that was done recently, I believe, by the University of Delaware, where they started to study student success, not academically, but socially. And what they found was that the more social students were, the more successful they were. So they asked them questions like, how many people did you meet this semester? How many new friends did you make? How many groups do you belong to? And what they found was that the students, again, that were more social, were actually more successful academically.
We're talking about all this because your firm Populous has been working on this with a project called Campus 2050. What is that project?
That project is something that we started about a year ago now. And again, it framed looking out. We looked out into the future. We picked 2050 because we thought that it was a date that was far enough away that we were unsure of the answers, but close enough that people could still relate to it. And we started to look at innovative companies in private business. So we started to look at Google, Uber, Netflix, Airbnb, things that are companies that are really changing the way we live our lives. And we said, well, what would happen if you took either their products or their business practices and overlaid those onto education? And that's where we started to come up with some innovative ideas about really going beyond just work sharing, but things like work sharing between faculty and students, having, again, everything at your fingertips on demand 24/7. We looked at how Uber and transportation is going to change over campuses and what would happen if you could recapture just 100 cars on a campus. You could potentially have another acre for green space or renewable energy or faculty housing, lots of different opportunities.
So essentially a fleet of Uber drivers taking people around campus instead of people having to park by one building or another.
Yes. Yeah. Yep, exactly.
I will say I hear you saying a lot of things about flexibility, about sort of putting things at people's fingertips. Are we sure that we really want all of these kinds of changes? For example, students eating in one building, living in another, studying in another. Isn't there something good about college students, you know, having to put on pants and go outside once in a while?
Yeah, and again, I don't think we're suggesting that you do everything in one building. What we're suggesting is that there are opportunities for these things to happen across campus.
Yeah.
So, for example, I may still wake up in sort of a traditional dormitory-style building my freshman year, but then I'll go and meet some classmates at an informal learning environment in an academic building where I then have a class where I then meet my instructor to go over some group work. And mm-hmm. from there, I can leave, go to a different building because I happen to like the fact that the local food truck pulls up into that building.
Right. Well, I mean, and you mentioned food. You know, I'm thinking that the ways people eat are changing as well. Does that affect, you know, I think about the traditional big college cafeteria that already seems to be replaced by more of a food court. Do you see that whole part of college life evolving further?
Yeah, I think we see definitely a trend towards more healthful options and more focus on nutrition itself. The other thing that we were able to do, being primarily a sports architecture firm, or at least traditionally a sports architecture firm, is to learn from some of the other work that we do in arenas, in stadiums, in convention centers, and try to pull trends from there as well. And nutrition is extremely big right now in collegiate athletics, making sure that student athletes have the proper nutrition, that it's convenient for them so that they're not grabbing something out of a vending machine, but rather that maybe they're getting a healthy shake or a healthy meal, some fresh fruit, again, opportunities to really disperse dining and not just have the traditional dining hall where you can get ice cream and pancakes 24/7, all you can eat.
Yeah. So from a building design standpoint, from how the campus looks and feels different, how is that different?
Well, we would see it as smaller dining hall, smaller centralized dining hall facilities, and then introducing either mobile dining options in and around other buildings, or perhaps some just smaller satellite facilities where you can grab a healthful option there.
You mentioned Netflix among the companies that you're trying to sort of take and overlay over the college learning environment. Can you give me an example of what you might learn from a Netflix that is translatable to you as a campus planner?
Sure. I think that's content on design and how you get course material. A lot of instructors are putting material out there, whether it's PowerPoint presentations or videos, but for the student to have the ability to start to get a lot of content on design and not just that particular day, but more content that's available to them online, and being able to share that content and have discussions around that content. And again, not just focusing on a student that is perhaps, as we think of them today, on their iPad or their iPhone or behind their computer by themselves, but providing opportunities and spaces, design spaces within campus where students can come together and share that video content with each other.
So Jeff, as you look to the future, and you mentioned taking your own child to college, when she's taking her child to college 30 years from now, what are you most looking forward to being different?
Really, I think it is all it's about the experience, and I would love to see my grandson or granddaughter have the ability to really design their own educational experience and not be sort of forced into a model that's been around for close to 1,000 years at that point.
Are there certain campuses in the country that you think are already sort of ahead of the curve on this, places that are giving us a glimpse of the future already?
I think there are spaces within some campuses. There are certainly, like I mentioned before, some campuses that are bringing corporate sponsors into the fold. There are some very unique spaces that are popping up in one space that I can think of called the garage, which was an old parking garage, which was retrofitted to become sort of a maker space where you can learn a lot of different, more tangible hands-on skills. But I don't see a sort of movement across a particular institution, more sort of piecemeal. And I think people are just kind of getting their feet wet at this point.
And private colleges, public universities, does it matter? Are we going to see the changes more quickly in one than the other?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I think it's an interesting question because some of the publics may, in fact, be the ones that need this the most, whether it's trying to conserve space and develop scalable projects and scalable institutions, whereas the privates, some of them that do have larger endowments would certainly have money to try to put things out there that are a little bit more risky and a little bit more innovative.
That's Jeff Funovitz, who joined us by Skype from Pittsburgh. Jeff, we'll check back in with you in, 33 years and see how it's all turned out.
Sounds good. You have my number.
Thanks so much, Jeff. He's a campus planner and also a principal at Populous. He lives in Pittsburgh. We'll follow up that discussion of the college campus by heading out to the bar, of course, and the clubs of Kansas City. It's a scene that by its nature tries to attract all kinds of people. Or does it? We'll hear stories that for people of color, the social scene here isn't always so inclusive and, in fact, may be driving people away. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. It was a month ago today that a lot of people in Kansas City heard for the first time about an event called Recovery Sundays, a monthly party at Californo's in Westport. That event had started in May and grown to hundreds of people by that Sunday afternoon in August. The reason a lot more people came to know about it that day is that a disagreement on the patio led to gunfire and killing of an innocent bystander, an off-duty police officer. Here's another layer to that tragedy. Recovery Sunday, as a large social event for young professional African Americans, was kind of a rarity in Kansas City, and many fear such spaces will now become even harder to find. Today we're asking why that is. Why do people of color not feel more widely welcome in Kansas City's nightlife and social scene? Aaron Randall, you wrote a big story in the Sunday Star about this. Let's start with Recovery Sunday. I know you were there the day of that shooting. Is that right?
Correct.
So take us back to before the shooting. What was that event all about?
It was a day party. It happened about it was a monthly event. Happened on Westport, and it was the best way I can describe it. It was just great summer vibes. Mm-hmm. It attracted a lot of Kansas City's Black millennial class, I guess you could say. And it was almost like a Nirvana. Like I had been there, been going for months. My cousin Quentin Randall was a DJ. He's one of the guys that threw the event, and it was just one of the few spaces where I feel like young Black professionals kind of felt welcomed and really included somewhere west of Truce in one of our top entertainment districts. It was just good vibes, good music, good people, you know, very little. I never witnessed any kind of altercation or anything negative happen. It was just, I can't explain it better than that. And just it was just very a great vibey kind of experience.
Yeah, I mean, talk about that vibe a little bit. What felt different about that space and that event, that monthly gathering, than heading out to some other restaurant on a Sunday afternoon?
Well, obviously, I think the major thing was that most of the people there were Black and they were young, in a space like Westport, where usually we are the minority. But also the music, you know, it felt like sometimes when you go out, most times when you go out in Kansas City as a person of color, you kind of notice that the music doesn't seem to be something that you're pretty much familiar with, or music that your preferred music, I would say. So the bass was hip hop and R&B. So the music was great. There was a bar. It was just a great venue. It was just a beautiful space, a beautiful event with beautiful people.
Yeah. So your article in the Kansas City Star this past Sunday introduces us to a number of people who talk about how this is not their regular experience in Kansas City.
Absolutely.
How not only do they not feel welcome in many bars, clubs, parts of the social scene, but it's driving them to actually leave the area, to not want to live here. You've lived places other than Kansas City. How do you think we compare to other cities?
Not favorably. Mm-hmm. I am born and raised in Kansas City, and in 2007 I went to D.C. I attended Howard University, and so that's kind of where I had my first introduction to the nightlife scene and social scenes, and it was kind of jarring because you don't realize your reality until you see an alternate reality. And when I went to D.C., just seeing just the array and the variety of events that Black people were accepted in all parts of the city was a riveting experience for me. You know, there were brunches, there were happy hours, and I have to make the distinction that it wasn't just like in that part of town. It was like you could go anywhere in DC and you just felt like you were being included, that you were wanted, that you were welcomed. And it was just interesting to come back here. I moved back here in 2015 and I saw the difference.
Well, and so I think sort of teasing out what that difference is in terms of, you know, this isn't a matter of African Americans being turned away for the most part or being told they can't come.
Correct.
How is that message nevertheless sent? You're not really welcome here.
I think it's sent. I think that the first instance that you notice is the music. I can't stress that enough. When it's like social scenes at night, like you can tell when music is being skewered one way, especially considering what is popular, like what dominates popular culture today, which is largely hip hop and R&B music. You get the feeling that there's a concentrated effort to not play certain types of music. And then when you learn, if you are privy to certain people in nightlife, certain nightlife agents, you know that that's not just a coincidence. It's actually a concentrated effort by some venue owners. And then it's just, I don't know, the way that some people have experiences at the door at some of these events. Sometimes they feel like they are unjustly prohibited from entering, or that they're giving a little bit more extra scrutiny than, say, maybe their white counterparts. I think that sometimes when you get inside, the vibe sometimes of the patrons who work in these venues just doesn't seem like they are the most welcoming. It's just an overall vibe of a lot of small minutiae that kind of adds up to being just an overall vibe of unwelcome.
Well, one of the people you talked with in your story was Carrington Harrison, who is also with us here in the studio today. Hello, Carrington.
Hey, how's it going? Aaron just said a lot of stuff that I'd like to piggyback on. I'm sure you'll ask me questions, but I thought he did a good job batting lead off.
And I appreciate that. And I mean, one of the things he just was talking about was music being one of the real ways of sending the message, some but not all are welcome here. And you work in music. You're a host on the radio, but you're also a DJ. You host some of these events, right?
Yeah. I thought that Aaron made a good point. I think that a lot of times music sets the atmosphere and the tone when you walk in the door. My friends, we call it the White People's Greatest Hits playlist, because when you walk in and you hear Sweet Caroline or Pour Some Sugar on Me, you know the atmosphere, like you know what time it is when you walk in the door. So I think a lot of times when you walk into the environment, pretty early on in the night, you can tell how welcoming or accessible it is to you.
And you yourself have experienced, perhaps in a way more blatant than some, things not being accessible, right?
Yeah, I am. I tried to book an event at a popular place, I don't know if you want me to name it again, Soul Cantina, in Martini Corner. And I thought I had a pretty good idea, a pretty good pitch, and it was going to be beneficial to all sides. And he blatantly just said, we don't play that kind of music here. We want to cater more to the yacht rock crowd. And I remember I just said, oh, okay. We shook hands and we walked off. And I told Aaron that story a while ago when I was just kind of spitballing ideas and kind of, and it came back up again, it resurfaced in the store.
So, I mean, what for you as a DJ, as a party host, what makes for a good event? What's the kind of event that you want to host where, you know, what restrictions would you not have to live under for the event to be, in your sense, in your view, really welcoming?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think people want the ability to create and be able to kind of dictate and set the mood and atmosphere for themselves. And I think the problem that Kansas City runs into is there are just not a lot of spaces that are able to give you that creative freedom in which you can dictate, set the vibe, set the atmosphere of the kind of event you want to throw. So I think if we're like looking for solutions and moving forward, that's going to be the big thing. Owners, bar areas, restaurant spaces, being able to give you that creative freedom. That creative freedom was given at Californo's, and the host of that were able to set the atmosphere and tone for it. And I was at Californo's that day too. You would never think something like that would happen at Californo's. It was always a very welcome environment. I mean, between Aaron and I, we probably knew, 150, 200 people there? Like, we knew a lot of people that was there. There was no reason to think that anything like this could happen.
I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation, too. Let me ask you, do you feel welcome on Kansas City's social scene? And we'd love to hear the experiences of people of color this morning. In fact, we'd like to hear from any of you. If you're a regular patron of the nightlife in Westport or at Power and Light or somewhere else in the city, what have you observed? Maybe you're a business owner. Let us hear from you. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. And let us know what you're thinking. Yeah, you both have mentioned music, Aaron and Carrington, about as one of the main ways of saying maybe not everyone's so welcome here by the musical limitations that are placed. But is there more to it than just music? You mentioned attitude at the door as well, Aaron. What else have you experienced?
I wanted to make one point. It kind of goes to what you said in the beginning about how I remember I talked to Aaron probably a week after this had happened, and we kind of talked about how we knew this was going to have a very big ripple effect throughout the community. And I think one of the frustrating things is I think black people are told every day in this country to not judge police officers based on the few select incidents that we see happen in our country. And we're told to judge the 90, 95% of police officers that do good. But whenever something like this happens in black social spaces, the entire black community is then judged and excluded from events. And we're not given the same respect that we're told to give to other people. That's the frustrating part. I think a lot of black millennials knew when this happened, it's going to have a ripple effect, not just for the rest of the summer, not just for the rest of 2017, but for years to come. Spaces are going to be unwilling to give it to you because they don't want that kind of crowd and energy in their place. That, again, why are we then able to judge the small minority of people that do cause problems at these and not the overwhelming majority of people that just want to have a good time?
Aaron, in your research, were there other ways that the message was sent, not everyone's really welcome?
Absolutely. Well, I know that many of our listeners may know about like maybe the history of Power and Light and, you know, how they had been kind of found to employ a variety of methods, right? There were accusations that they had what they called rabbits, where they would like kind of plant people in bars to start fights, specifically with patrons of color. Also, I personally myself, I've been to, you know, again, like the dress code restrictions that is not uniformly enforced. I have been actually to a club, actually wearing these pants I have on now, and because they had like a drawstring at the top, they look like jeans, but they have a drawstring, so I was told I could not come into that club. Wow. And the lady that I was with, she kind of petitioned on my behalf and got me in after about 5 minutes of politicking, and we literally had not even got one drink yet, and a group of white guys came in and they literally had on like the swishy, like breakaway warm-up pants that you see like at a basketball game. And I brushed it off, but she was furious. She went to the bar. She went to the security guard like, well, what's the deal? You know, he had on almost legitimate jeans and couldn't get in. They had on swishy pants. And the bartender's like, oh, well, they're just friends of the owner. And I tell them, don't wear that, but it just happened. So could they have been friends of the owner? Maybe. But, you know, it was just ironic to see it so blatantly enforced right in front of my face. And yeah. I feel like that's an experience that a lot of people have had.
You know, I want to read something out of your story, Aaron, if I can. You spoke with Bill Nigro, who's a business owner in Westport, very active in
yes.
sort of neighborhood-wide initiatives. And one of the things you reported was that Nigro says he said very openly that he uses methods like DJ and music restrictions to keep certain elements out. The element he says he's keeping out is guns. Mm-hmm. And I'll just read a little of his quotes. He said, "I don't believe in playing hip-hop and rap music and drawing a specific crowd. I'm not looking for that. I've owned a few country nightclubs, and I've had fewer problems out of that crowd. If that makes me racist, fine. If somebody's offended by that, fine. People get afraid to talk about race," he continues. This is Bill Nigro. "But you have to talk about it when you're in the nightlife business. Security, too. They go hand in hand. And if you don't talk about those two things, it'll put you out of business."
I at least appreciate his honesty and candor because he's just open with his racism.
I truly did.
Like, he wasn't like, it wasn't under the surface. It was pretty blatant. "We don't want you black people here. I'm telling everybody we don't want you here," which, I mean, I don't like, but I at least respect the honesty of it.
And do you think that's representative of other business owners in Westport in your experience?
Absolutely. I've experienced it, I think, at more than a few bars in Westport, and just in conversations off the record with DJs and other nightlife agents, they have kind of corroborated, you know, my suspicions. And I have to say that my conversation with Bill Nigro was very fascinating. I did not, and I know that he has been a major takeaway for many people in this article, but I did not come away feeling like he was nefarious or like really in, like, intending to be as vehemently racist as he sounded. And I actually appreciate, like Carrington said, him saying it so openly, because I think people are so afraid to have the conversation. And that's what I think I enjoyed about the way people have engaged this article. I'm not trying, this was not vitriolic. I was not trying to attack anyone. I'm just saying that this is people's reality. And if we don't put it out in the open, we don't discuss it, then it, you know, we can't conquer it.
I will say people seem very willing to discuss it this morning. Our board lit up with calls when we gave the number. That number, again, is 816-235-2888. And let's hear from some of those callers. Let's talk to Erica in Kansas City. Hi, Erica. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you. This is a very timely conversation. I read the article. Aaron, it was great. And I actually saw some of my friends that were quoted in there. I went to Howard University in Washington, D.C. and have had quite a few other alumni move out here and then leave within a year or two, despite concerted efforts to try to get them to stay. And outside the social aspect of this, there is an economic impact. We don't always get to have the best and the brightest in Kansas City. And the best and the brightest can be regardless of what your race is. As employees and as entrepreneurs, because they're not happy here. I have seen with my own eyes discrimination happen at the front door, different venues. I felt it myself. And for these entrepreneurs and this workforce, they have choices. And they don't have to be in Kansas City when they leave. And so as a person from Kansas City, I love Kansas City, born and raised here. It's disturbing to know that we're not growing the way that we probably could and don't have the opportunities that we should have here for those that really could contribute to this community.
Hey, Erica, thank you so much for calling and sharing that perspective.
The only part of the story... Thank you, Erica.
Thanks,
Erica. The only part I disagreed with Aaron in the story was I don't think Westport is utopic at all, but I think that Westport at least feels welcoming in the sense of, I think a group of under 40-year-old black people feel comfortable enough to go to Westport and have a good time. To me, the bigger issue and the biggest area of division in our city is power and light. For a city that is based on a dividing line that we all know east and west divides our city racially, there's no place that represents that more than power and light. The power and light is not a place you even consider. So while, again, Westport is not a perfect utopia and not a heaven-sent kind of place, you at least feel like that's a place you can go. You don't feel like you can go to Power and Light.
I want to take one more call before we have to go to a break. Darren is with us from Kansas City. Hi, Darren.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I just would like to comment, long and short, if you don't feel welcome, if these clubs and these businesses are doing so well economically and you feel they're not trying to be inclusive, I'm just leave it alone. I mean, this is nothing new under the sun. It's easier said than done, but you have black professionals. You have people who want to go somewhere and have a good time. Just invest in someplace else. Invest and pull your resources, buy a spot, and open up a club. I mean, I think it's a non-issue. You know, the businesses in Kansas City will suffer at some point for their non-inclusivity, but for the most part, I think it's a non-issue personally. And I'm that 40 and above crowd that you were referring to. I tend to go out. I tend to have a great time. At no point do I feel like I've been pushed aside or, you know, discriminated against or even treated badly. But what I'm hearing, it sounds like, well, I don't feel welcome. I don't feel like they're trying to be inclusive.
And so you should just go somewhere else.
Yeah, you don't have to. You got, the best way to show people you mean business and that you stand for something these days, I find, is to hurt them economically.
Okay,
you
Darren, I appreciate it. I'm so sorry to cut you off, but we got so many calls.
Fine.
Just real quickly, Aaron, what's wrong with, do you disagree? I mean, can the market just take care of this problem and go find somewhere else to have drinks?
I disagree. I think that it is important to confront discrimination and to confront wrongdoing, and the answer is not to move away. And also, that's a fascinating question or point that people have brought up, you know, just open your own. That opens a whole nother conversation about, well, what spaces are even welcoming for ownership as far as black bars in places west of Troost.
Yeah, easier said than done. Central Standard needs to take one more short break. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. We will come back and continue this conversation and meet other guests who have been observing and experiencing the feeling of not being fully welcome in Kansas City's social scene. 816-235-2888 is the number to call to join the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We are talking today about the state of Kansas City's social scene, especially for people of color. And Cecilia Ananya Belzer-Patton is with us. Hello, Cecilia.
Hey, how are you doing?
Welcome back to KCUR.
Thank you.
Among other things in town, you helped host and organize the White Privilege Conference here in Kansas City earlier this year. And I guess my question to you is, in your experience, are the dance floors and bar stools of Kansas City one of the places where white privilege is really on display?
I would say so, and has been for a long time. And I think we also have a very long history of that, going back to J.C. Nichols and the redlining of our city, the Plaza. You know, when I was these young men's age coming up, you know, we still were a bit uncomfortable to even have dinner at the Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
And so we think about these things, and I completely disagree with the gentleman, Darren, who was on before when he said we should just find our other places. Yes, we should have places of comfort. And equally so, we should not feel limited by places where we are uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. I do remember at the conference, actually, mm-hmm. that the organizers included in the packet a list of businesses where attendees, mm-hmm. especially people of color, might want to direct their business.
Yes.
How did you decide who made that list?
We decided that as a host committee, and we were very clear about wanting to have people of color own businesses. It's interesting. Kansas City Power and Light came up with that, where we did not want to direct people to Kansas City Power and Light because of the history of Kansas City Power and Light.
Even though it was so close to the conference.
Even though it was so close to the conference and how they have greeted people in our city as people of color, especially African Americans. And so I do think that we should utilize our economic power, our social savvy to bring light to these spaces, not to say, oh, we want to shame you or we want to do these things, but we want to bring about conversation that will open up why this is so and why these implicit biases continue in 2017. And as Carrington said, the implicit bias of, oh, if there's one violent event, then a whole culture is deemed monolithic. When there's one violent event that happens with a police department, the whole police department is not deemed in a monolithic way. So why should we be?
Mm-hmm.
And I think until we are willing to have those types of conversations, until we're willing to lean in and say, we deserve to be here as much as you do, and that we will continue that, even if it makes people uncomfortable or it confronts white fragility, so be it. We're going to have those conversations.
Aaron and Carrington shared personal experiences mm-hmm. of having been made to feel unwelcome at particular businesses in town. Have you had that experience as well?
Oh, for many years, you know. I've also lived outside of Kansas City. I was not born here, but reared here most of my life. And was in New York City for over a decade. My brother lives in the D.C. area. It is amazingly different when one is here in Kansas City. I've had those things on the Plaza, in Power and Light. Westport, not as much, but definitely in Westport as well.
Can you give an example of like a time where
that happened? Sure. You know, just the aspect of I feel very different. I'm greeted very differently when I present myself in a space that's more white-centered, when my hair is blown out, when it's straight, than I do when my hair is in its natural state, when it's curly, or if I'm funked out in how I'm looking that day, or if I'm talking like I'm talking to my friends as opposed to talking on KCUR. And so I think that I've had that experience. I was recently at a restaurant on the plaza where one of my girlfriend's daughter-in-law works, who is Latina, and was shared with that they use a coded language of Canadians in referring to African-Americans that they don't want to be sat in their section because they feel like that we don't tip appropriately. And so this is an ongoing thing. It's been going on for many years, and we just continue to plan on confronting it.
You mentioned your hair seeming to make a difference. Is there a gender aspect to this too? As a Black woman, do you think you are in a especially vulnerable category for this kind of discrimination?
I have experienced that. I think as a woman, period, the kind of liberty to go out singly in our city is not there. I did not feel that when I was in New York City or even in D.C. I felt like I could be safe in spaces by myself. There are places in Kansas City where I don't feel like I could be safe by myself. In the night scene, KC Power and Light is one. There's been racially coded language about my body that is thrown at me in Kansas City Power and Light just a couple of months ago when I was meeting friends there and I was walking by myself. Definitely one has to be more aware of that. And in places where it's interesting to me, my white friends might find Troost a space where they feel uncomfortable, or east of Troost. And I've often said that I often feel uncomfortable in Johnson County and Lee's Summit and Blue Springs. And they find that strange because they think of safety in reference to us. And sometimes I think of safety in reference to whiteness.
I want to check in with one of our callers who we know here at KCUR. This is Raven, who used to be an intern here. Hello, Raven. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Brian.
Nice to hear from you, Raven. You've experienced some of this yourself as well, right?
So I'm a young Black woman, but I'm also an artist, a poet. And what I found is that, especially in the creative spaces, the art spaces where it's supposed to be labeled as quote unquote safe. White people love labeling things. But they're really just venting sessions for white people. And it's truly a competition between white mediocrity and Black excellence. And that just means Black people have to work 100 times harder to be respected, to be notarized. And if we want to stay on the East Side, that adds a whole nother layer of competition. I spit a poem last Wednesday called Angry White Women Are Amusing, and it basically calls out like white feminists in their silence. And there was basically white tears to follow me, but it's going to be really hard to go back into that space, feel accepted in that space, because I have to call out like even white supremacy when it is in a quote unquote safe space. I really feel like the caliber of art, the requirement is not even, it's not fair to be considered great.
Appreciate that. And thank you for sharing that, Raven. I really appreciate you calling in today. Good to hear from you. Take care.
You too.
Cecilia, you're going to respond
to that. As many people know, I received my Master of Fine Arts in Theater from UMKC here. And I do think that there is this perception that because there are many artists in Kansas City and that artists are perceived to be liberal and progressive, that these spaces are safe for people of color. And I'd like to challenge our thought about that. I'd like to agitate our thought about that. Very aware in moving back to Kansas City in 2011 how not integrated spaces like Crossroads were on the first Friday. And it still is a punch to the gut to experience First Friday and become aware, because I am aware of my surroundings, of even in the attempt to come further east on 18th Street, we stopped that attempt at about Oak. You know, I start to see some things about that this summer. And so that to me is a message. Yeah. It's a message of how separated things are here.
We're talking about Kansas City's social scene and the place of people of color in it. We've got Aaron Randall of the Kansas City Star and Carrington Harrison, a local party host and also from 610, and Cecilia Ananya Belzer-Patton. We also have on the phone with us now a national correspondent for the New York Times, John Eligo, who is based here in Kansas City. John, thanks for taking a few minutes with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You cover race for the New York Times. How does this story and your own experience here compare with other parts of the country?
Yeah, well, I think you see a version of this across many parts of the country, you know, whether it be obviously St. Louis or our sister city across I-70, or you see it in Minneapolis and whatnot. And I think the thing that really struck me about this is when you look at Bill Nigro's comments, and the fact that there's been such a muted, I would say in some ways, no response from either other business owners in the city, other political leaders in the city, to me, that says a lot about the state of racism in Kansas City and how normalized it is that someone could say, basically, they do not want black people in their businesses, and that could go unchecked or unchallenged by anyone. It kind of makes me wonder, you know, in terms of how serious the city is about dealing with issues of racism and even taking seriously a lot of the people that Aaron and other people talked to in the article.
And John, I mean, one of the things I'm curious about is having covered issues of race in cities around the country, a lot of the comparisons we've made here to cities that do seem more welcoming, Washington, D.C., New York,
yep.
These are much larger cities than Kansas City. Is that part of what's happening here, or are there some unique things about Kansas City, even as a smaller city, that are contributing to this problem?
Well, I don't think it's just the size of the city, because I think, you know, you do have, you know, large cities that still have a lot of these issues and still have the problem. I think what you have in Kansas City is you have, there doesn't seem to be a willingness to engage with the topic. You know, I think Cecilia mentioned that. You know, it's really about how does the city engage with it. And also, if you look from the perspective of, and this is something I think you see across the board in other cities, is when we talk about what the one caller said about, you know, why don't we just open our own spaces? That is actually a very good point. But the issue is, if you look at how wealth has been generated and how wealth has been withheld from black communities throughout the country in certain ways, wealth is needed to open up these businesses. So what are cities doing proactively to allow black owners to be in the major entertainment districts, which are going to have the higher, you know, rent and whatnot, which are going to cost more? What is the city doing proactively to balance and to close that gap? And those are the types of things that I think need to be addressed in Kansas City as well as other cities.
Well, let me ask some of our other guests, stick around if you would, John. But Carrington Harrison, I mean, if you could say to the city, here's a proactive step you can take, what would it be?
I just think inclusion and just the opportunity. I think that more than anything, I don't think that black people want exceptions or to be treated differently. We just want equality. That if I come to you with an idea that can make money and be beneficial for both of us, why am I being discriminated against because of your preconceived notions about a certain crowd? If we both can win, why are you accepting it? And I think too many times there is a belief that some bars rather lose with white people or not have anybody in it than be full of black people.
Mm-hmm. And Aaron, I mean, as you've obviously not only done the reporting for this story, but heard the feedback afterward. Do you have a sense of what a way forward might be for the businesses and the government of Kansas City?
Absolutely. I think in one way, so often the onus is placed on black people. And I think we need to reverse that. Doing this story, I thought a lot about MLK's Birmingham letter and his feelings toward the white moderate. And I think that this is a burden. This is a burden for allies as well. And, you know, doing this reporting, I was astounded by how many fellow white business owners in Westport were like, yeah, it does go on and it is bad, but I don't want to talk about it because it could hurt me. Like the bar that we set for allyship is so low. And I think that it's important that white people who know better should do better. And if you know that in this country, we place a premium on white comfort over black well-being. And unless we start to reverse that and really those who know better work with people of color to accost those who are implementing these racist practices, that's one way to really change the narrative and to change the way people think and the way people act.
And I guess I would say, to kind of piggyback off Aaron's point, I think a lot of times is when you're asked to, hey, share your experience, tell people how you feel about X, Y, and Z, the moment you do it, you are then led with, no, that didn't happen. You have to have a greater standard of burden to prove it. If I told you you got robbed, you didn't have to go through X, Y, and Z to prove it.
And Cecilia, let me give you the last word as you hear. What's the way forward?
You know, I've been thinking about this quite a lot, especially since 2014 when Huffington Post said City of Kansas City is the place to be. And I've said to my friends, both my allies, my friends, people who look like me, don't look like me, for some. And I would like it to be the city to be for all.
John Illigo of the New York Times, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks, Ben.
And Cecilia Ananya, Belzer Patton, Carrington Harrison, and Aaron Randall, thank you all for your perspectives today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is all the time we have, but you can listen back to the discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard, including our talk earlier about the future of campus design. It's kcur.org/centralstandard. Keep talking about this on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Tag us. Tag me, too. I'm at PTS Brian. Tomorrow, we talk about how climate change is making our food less nutritious. That's tomorrow at 10. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.